Well, good morning and welcome to Inspiration. I'm your host, Jessica Turvey, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, an information access service. Inspiration, well, it's all around you. From the moment you awaken and splash cool and refreshing water on your face, breathe in deeply that morning air and feel the rays of sunlight on your face. In today's program, well, I'm looking forward to putting a smile on your face and maybe even giving you some thoughts to share with someone else a little later this morning. I hope you're enjoying this Christmas season. I have a few more stories that I'd like to share with you this week that are part of our holiday magic. This first story was written by Ralph W. Seeger. It's called Christmas in the Country. Everywhere, Christmas tonight. Yet nowhere is it more beautifully simple than in the country. To the everlasting glory of innkeepers everywhere, the one in Luke saw to it that Mary knew her time in the midst of things of home, country things. He was the fourth wise man, and I'd say he was the wisest of all. Surely the clean straw, the warmth of cattle, and the soft bleating of the sheep had the best to offer to this night. Where else could shepherd boys have knelt with kings? Where else could doves and donkeys have been so well at home? Where else a better place for the good shepherd than among the lambs? Small wonder, when a young, fleecy head came under her hand, that Mary looked to her own child and murmured, "Lamb." There were crickets at her feet, and the velvet cheek of the ox at her shoulder, watching over Mary. The bull and the ox take the privilege of custody upon themselves when it comes to babes and children. Farmers have told me that their infant child is the safest member of the family around the bull. It may be that some strange yet holy heritage has come down to them from the Christmas stable. I witnessed this strange heritage once at the state fair. There stood the vast and arrogant bull, shackles on his feet, his nose ringed and chained. Bovine and behemoth, he towered in majesty above all of his kindred kind. Pitchfork guardians, alert to his great strength, were with him constantly. Evidently, there was basis for apprehension on their part. Now comes the miracle. I have since come to accept. A small boy, a toddler, walked along between the iron stanchions and then stopped by this bull. The boy patted his hand against the heavy rods, while from his child's throat came diminutive sounds in his own private language. I was tempted to draw him away, but something held my hand back. Anyway, the pen separated them safely. The child thrust his hand between the bars, trying to touch that massive beast, but he could not reach so high. Then the enormous head lowered, and the bull came down on his knees, pressing his face to the barricade. The child cooed with glee as he fondled that monstrous, yet noble head. I watched enthralled. It was a lovely scene. At the risk of skepticism, I must go on to say that I saw a glistening, a moistness come into the glance of this creature. Whatever else it could have been, something much like weeping filled his plum eyes. Of course, an arm-jerking mother came along and dragged the child away on the backs of his heels. I turned to the pitchforkers and asked whether the child was familiar to the bull. "No," they answered. "He's never seen him before." From barn to meadow, valley to mountain, the countryside is the Creator's best witness of his goodwill to his children. Here is man's first and ultimate home, where he knows compassion in the shelters of great oaks and in the touch of beasts. That story called Christmas in the Country was written by Ralph W. Seeger. How about I take a moment and just shift over to a poem? It's called Unusual Christmas Gifts. It's by Georgia B. Adams. I'm wrapping up some different gifts at Christmas time this year, Besides the gifts most usual, I'm trying up some cheer. I'm taking it to one shut-in. In wrappings bright and gay, I'm wrapping up some happiness to brighten someone's day. I'll take a heaping measure of warm faith and bits of joy for family and friends of mine, for smallest girl and boy. I'll take some stardust and a dream for that loved one of mine. I'll even wrap a kiss or two along with love divine. And then I'll wrap up months of hope, 12 months, in fact, 'twill be, to last till Christmas comes again and give the gift from me. That poem, Unusual Christmas Gifts, was written by Georgia B. Adams. There are so many wonderful holiday stories that are out there. I had a really tough time picking and choosing what you might like to hear today. But this one came jumping to my mind and jumping to the top of the pile. It's called Moving Christmas. It's by Pamela Kennedy. Pamela writes, "I have a new respect for the Magi. You know, those guys who packed up their camels and headed out without any form of GPS, more sophisticated than following yonder star. I read somewhere that their trip took over a year. Imagine deciding what to take. Smart of them to pack gifts that didn't require much space, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But how many changes of cloaks did they bring? What about turbans or accessories? It had to be wrenching to leave their books and astrological accoutrements behind. No room for those on a camel. My first admiration for these ancient Middle Eastern travelers stems from my own recent activities. The children are grown and gone, setting up their own nests in far-flung cities. The family pet has passed on to her eternal reward. The career is coming to a close, and it's time to downsize as we move from our house into a condo. Don't get me wrong. I like the sound of the word. It makes me feel contemporary, frugal, and slender, all at the same time. Yes, we're downsizing, I say, as if we're on a happy campaign. But the reality of downsizing is that to become what it sounds like, you actually have to make some serious decisions about getting rid of things and basically say goodbye to parts of your past. Some decisions are easy. I never really liked that old overstuffed chair or the framed print of the 4-masted schooner. But other choices are more difficult. How many of Grandma's painted plates should we keep? And what about the hundreds of photos of us on vacation? Then I come to the Christmas decor. I count out a dozen handmade gingham stars trimmed with tiny rickrack. They are a bit crooked and the stitches aren't even. My mother sewed them as she sat outside the hospital delivery suite while I labored giving birth to our son. Mother is gone now and our son is 34. There's an angel made of macaroni that our eldest created in kindergarten and a reindeer crafted from a clothespin by our daughter in first grade. The hand-painted globe my father gave us on our first anniversary nestles in a box beside a delicate porcelain angel my husband brought from overseas. One by one, I remove treasured memories from the plastic storage boxes labeled Christmas. By the time my husband returns, I am sitting on the floor surrounded by ornaments, needlepoint wall hangings, embroidered stockings, candles, a variety of nativity characters, and a felt tree skirt embellished with crystal beads and sequins. Next to me, sitting empty, are 2 large bags labeled Toss and Give Away. After hours, I have found nothing in either category. "Hey," he asks cheerfully, "how's the downsizing going?" I look at him and tears fill my eyes. I can't speak past the lump in my throat, so I offer him what I have in my hand, a small stuffed angel with blue button eyes and tousled blonde hair. It reminds me of our daughter. He takes the angel and looks at the mess on the floor. Then he begins to methodically repack everything into the large plastic cartons. He is quick and efficient, and before long, everything is back in its place. "What are you doing?" I finally ask as he stacks the cartons one upon the other. "What about downsizing?" He helps me to my feet, brushes some glitter from my hair, and smiles. "Don't worry about it, baby. This year, we're moving Christmas." That was the title of the story that Pamela Kennedy wrote, Moving Christmas. Just before I go on in my reading, let me just remind you that you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, where we offer 24 hours a day, 7 days a week of programming from over 265 publications. Well, sometimes when we get into our holiday season, we sometimes can get into some rather uncomfortable exchanges with people, or just things that we'd like to say and maybe shouldn't say, but we don't know what to do about it. Well, let me explain in more detail as I read you this next story. It is actually a question that was written into Crucial Conversations. It was written to Joseph Grenny, and the title of this question was Sometimes It's About the Conversation You Don't Have. So here is the question that was posed to Joseph, and then we'll take a look at what he and how he responded. Dear Joseph, I attend a church with a small congregation. One of our members sings at the top of her lungs and is very much off key, always. She overpowers the rest of us. I have witnessed people plugging an ear or intentionally sitting farther away. It seems that something could or should be said to her. Everyone wants to be loving and kind. No one wants to offend her. We want to embrace our members. I want her to enjoy her singing. How would you approach this situation? Sincerely, Silent in the Pew. So let's see how Joseph handles this question. Dear Silent in the Pew, Joseph writes, I'm going to take a leap since you use the word church and assume you worship in a Christian tradition. Please forgive me if my assumption is incorrect and translate what I say to your own faith. My answer to your question depends on your answer to mine. And here's the question. Why do you go to church? What do you really want? I could give you advice on giving tough feedback to a potentially defensive person. I could help you manage your emotions so your judgment wouldn't corrupt your communication with her. I could even give you tips on how to reconnect with her if she spiraled into defensiveness after you let her know what you think of her singing. But all of these would be like perfuming a pig. Aesthetic treatments don't change the animal. Before I elaborate, let me sympathize. I know what it's like to feel persistent eruptions of judgment. I hate that feeling. I suspect everyone has some pet peeves that trigger an unpleasant cascade of irritation, resentment, and even anger. For example, when I'm on an airplane and the person behind me speaks to the person inches to his left at 96 decibels for almost the entirety of a 5-hour flight, I can crockpot my resentments into a melodious stew for the full journey. The question is it his volume that is heating me up? I've learned something absolute about hot flashes of judgment. My judgments are always about me. His decibels don't correlate with my derision. I know this is true because I can look to my left and right on the plane and see that others seem to be largely unaffected. They're reading their books, gazing out the window, or carrying on their own conversations without being consumed with vengeful fantasies like I am. How can this be? Well, it happens this way because his loudness is alchemized by my thoughts. How inconsiderate, I think to myself. He thinks he is so important. He knows better and is doing it anyway. He's an egotistical jerk. Well, you get the idea of what my thoughts are. Could thoughts like this happen at church? Oh, yes. Could it be that your feelings about the woman singing are not just about the lack of musical quality, but are produced by judgments like these? Yes, again. It's possible you'll find relief by getting her to lower her volume, but you won't find growth. So why are you at church? Are you there for music appreciation? If so, by all means, have the conversation. If you're there because you're trying to learn to create a Christian community, then her pitch and volume might be the greatest gifts she could give you. Please don't read me as self-righteous in what I'm about to say. This sermon is for me, and you're welcome to listen in. When Jesus organized his small congregation, he first invited lepers with ghastly sores, hated tax collectors, scandalous adulterers, and perhaps even a bad singer or two. His offer was to gather all those who were off-key in their own unique way and help them learn to be one. I think the harmony he was after began first with each learning that their judgments were their judgments and wouldn't be solved by fixing the other. They would be solved by receiving and then offering grace. And Joseph finishes with this. I suggest the best way to find the harmony and beauty you're after is to ask yourself in those disturbing moments, what do I really want? Then raise your voice in glorious cacophony with your sister. Signed, with best wishes, Joseph. Do you remember the modern-day Aesop that I've read about over the last few years? His name is Cary Patterson, and they call him the modern-day Aesop because he writes stories and fables like no one else in this day and age, always with a message. Today, I'd like to share with you one of his stories, one of his parables called Unseen in Plain Sight. Cary starts with this. Is that for the Christmas pageant? Mr. Mulrooney asked as I stuffed a 6-foot artificial tree into the passenger seat of our VW Bug. No, I answered. It's just a little something to dress up my cubicle at school. Well, our neighbor continued, you can't get started too early when it comes to the pageant. No siree, not when it comes to the pageant. The event to which Mr. Mulrooney was referring was our congregation's annual potluck dinner, complete with a visit from Santa Claus, holiday carols, and the ever-favorite nativity play performed by the Sunday school children. Later that day, as I mentioned the upcoming gathering to my wife, Louise, we both spoke of how enjoyable the pageant had been over the years. Then we quickly added, hopefully we'll be assigned to do something simple, like bake a pie. Just then, the phone rang. But we don't have money to pay for any incidental expenses that might arise if we take charge of the pageant, I pleaded to our pastor. Plus, I'm in the final stages of graduate school. Louise and I don't have time to be in charge of an entire Christmas program. Naturally, there was parish money set aside for the pageant's expenses. So my poverty plea faded quickly, and my complaint about not having time was, well, nobody ever has time to produce a holiday pageant, and yet somehow we enjoy one every year. Actually, the job is easier than you might imagine, the pastor explained. You simply delegate the various activities to other congregants. You're in the business school. You should know all about delegation, right? Low blow, I thought to myself. All right, I acquiesced, but only under the following conditions. Louise and I will stay within the budget and assign out all of the work. Joyful preparations, the pastor corrected. We'll assign out the joyful preparations, I continued, but only if we have total control. We don't want to be second-guessed. Right down to his last ho-ho-ho, the pastor agreed. The deal was sealed. Here's our first decision, Louise proclaimed. It has to do with St. Nick. Let me guess, I said. There won't be a St. Nick at our gathering? Bingo, she responded. We've had enough Santa calamities to last a lifetime. Louise was referring to a couple of recent holiday flops. One year, our pastor thought it would be clever if he himself played the jolly old fellow. But he was so skinny that the pillows he stuffed under his crushed satin costume kept falling out. The overall effect was creepy. Young children cried as he approached them, one emaciated hand clenching a candy cane, the other holding tightly to his leaking torso. The next year, we reversed course by hiring a professional Santa Claus. Unfortunately, the guy was so serious about his craft that he insisted everyone remain absolutely silent as he delivered a lengthy lecture on the evils of consumerism. Eventually, the old elf chewed out the celebrants and left in a huff. Between these two events, I don't know which left the children more scarred. Since our pageant didn't include Santa, we had time to add group singing and tree decorating to the program. A vocal orchestration grad student was assigned to lead the music, and as we had hoped, it went off flawlessly. The music was sublime. I can't say the same for the tree decorating. It turns out, according to the decorators at least, there are two kinds of Christmas tree aficionados. Those who hang tinsel in orderly rows that show proper respect for the sacred holiday, and undisciplined heathens who carelessly hurl fistfuls of tinsel at the angel atop the tree. Let's just say the activity was tense. And then there was the nativity scene. Screenwriters typically portray them as disasters by having either the bleachers collapse or the kids fumble the script. The truth is, as the children, particularly the little ones, forget their lines, trip over their bathrobes, and knock down the set pieces, the pageant gets that much more adorable. I'm proud to say that ours was the most adorable ever. My favorite part of the evening took place in plain sight, and yet, with many acts of kindness, it largely remained unseen. Louise and I had assigned the much-anticipated holiday meal to the Fishers, a grad student in physics, his wife, and their three children. We asked them to organize a potluck dinner, easy peasy. Plus, they needed to buy a couple dozen pre-cooked turkey breasts that would be the crown jewel of the feast. In retrospect, the Fishers were probably an unwise choice. As poor as most of us congregants were, they were the poorest. Their view of what was supposed to be a lip-smacking turkey meal had been so distorted by years of going without that even though they had a generous budget to work from, the Fishers purchased 2 dozen dirt-cheap, refrigerated, bologna-like concoctions that they thought were delicious and everyone else feared. As each pressed turkey breast was ceremoniously placed on the serving table by the Fishers, it jiggled in true Christmas fashion, like a bowl full of jelly. Before the crowd could pounce on the Fishers for choosing this gelatinous, nearly translucent pressed turkey parts that could be carved with a plastic spoon, Louise proclaimed, "Oh, look, turkey aspic. Just like the elegant food they eat in France. How chic!" From that point on, Louise graciously shielded the Fishers from the disappointed crowd with her raw energy and optimistic talk of fancified French food. Eventually, Louise found a way to set aside most of the untouched pressed turkey breasts and give them to the Fishers, who had stayed behind to help with the cleanup. With a few subtle moves and a well-chosen word or two, Louise had graciously and respectfully provided a needy family with food they were able to freeze and then consume over the entire next semester. 3 decades later, when we ran into the Fishers at the local shopping mall, quite by accident, Our conversation quickly turned to that Christmas party. I still remember all that turkey we were able to take home and freeze, Pat Fisher enthused. It was yummy and lasted us for months. It was literally an answer to our prayers. I later learned that Louise didn't remember much about that meal. And why should she? Her handling of what could have been an embarrassing situation was so natural and selfless that it wasn't something she'd recall. It was just something she did. And so it was with all the parishioners. From cleaning up the little shepherd who ate too much fudge, to learning that there wasn't going to be a Santa Claus and not freaking out, everyone didn't merely celebrate the holiday, they lived it, one tiny act at a time. Let me leave you with this final thought from Carrie Patterson. As you stretch and get on with your week and look forward to your year ahead, Carrie writes, "May your holiday season be similarly real. May you experience joy not only from, say, hosting a pageant, but also from enacting simple deeds of service that for years to come are likely to remain unseen in plain sight. And isn't that how it's supposed to be?" Thank you for listening to Inspiration, and make it a great day. I'm Jessica Turvey, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour information access service.